Okay, thank you very much. Well, the work is actually, in the end, mostly done by the students. So the advisors often just have dreams and the students do the work, and Alex is laughing there. He knows what I'm talking about. Okay. Let's see if I can get this to work. So, how to do tailor model operations in the best possible way is something that is really not at all trivial. And so that's what this talk is going to be about. So we had a brief discussion yesterday that one could just have all these coefficients to be intervals, and that's certainly one way that actually has some disadvantage for long-term behavior, because one needs to worry about these guys blowing up. But in our implementation, we store the coefficients as floating point numbers. And so the original approach with these floating point numbers now has two issues. So first of all, how do I most efficiently figure out where what kinds of coefficients I have to multiply and what I have to add if they are stored somehow, because a multivariate polynomial is a not so trivial object. And then what's really the best way to deal with these round-off errors? And so I want to go into these two topics and then see how all this extends in a natural way to do arbitrary precision, where arbitrary is to be taken with a grain of salt. In our case, arbitrary means a few times floating point precision, and we're not going to get into the territory of what Natalie can do with thousands of digits or something like that. So arbitrary means, well, you know, it's kind of an engineering arbitrary, so if you're willing to wait enough, then even ours would really be arbitrary. But our goal is to make it particularly efficient for something like maybe four times machine precision, and that already is quite a bit. So now, where do the problems come from? First of all, if you want to do automatic differentiation or polynomial operations or whatever you want to call it, in one variable, that is all a piece of cake. You just draw all these coefficients one after another, and then when you are ready to multiply, well, you know that the nth order is made by all decompositions of n into a sum of lower order. So you take the zeroth order of the first times the nth of the second plus the first of the first and the n minus first of the second, and so on. And this addressing scheme is very, very easy. You just store the ith coefficient, which is calculated like this, and you're done. So very straightforward. Things are, and then how does one do intrinsics? That can be reduced to the addition and multiplication. Well, anyway, addition is just component-wise. So that's very easy. And the intrinsics, there is various methods. The methods we like is by re-expansion around the constant part and using a Taylor expansion for the non-constant part. And that method also prevents to the Taylor model world in just the same way. Now, here are some more examples. Let's not get into this. Now, in the higher dimensional case, all kinds of problems arise. Now, from a point of view of modern computer science, such a high-order polynomial is just a nice tree, starting with a constant part, and then you have branches to the first variable, second variable, third variable, and so forth. Then from the first variable, you have another branch to first variable squared, first times second, and so on. That is conceptually very nice, in practice hopelessly inefficient, and in particular also because of the fact of, first of all, it's very hard to find your way around in this tree when you want to identify particular coefficients. And then also, if in reality you want to use sparsity, which in this even in this linear case, in this one variable case, we have not done, But as soon as you use sparsity, then your tree has missing branches and what have you. Finally, in the tree representation that is not unique, you can write x1, x2 either as a descendant of x1 or one of x2, or you can split them in the middle, which is particularly inefficient, and write it as a descendant of x1 and x2. So how does one get around all of this? Well, let's do a little bit of a study here. So first of all, let's do a little bit of combinatorics. First question is, how many monomials are there up to order n in V variables? And that is actually not quite so trivial, but there is a rather elegant way to see that part. Well, all these guys, of course, can be written in such a way, and they are uniquely coded by the exponents I1 to IV. And the sum of all these guys is such that they are less than or equal to n. Now, if I have such a particular thing, let's consider x1 squared times x2 cubed times x4 and so forth. I code this in the following way. I write two ones for the fact that this is a 2, then some kind of delimiter, then three more ones for I2, one more one for I3, and so forth. And so then each monomial is uniquely represented in such a way by choices of ones and stars. Okay, but if there's nothing occurring, then this string has, there's nothing in the string.
Some zeros. In other words, those three
yeah. Okay, so right now I'm asking only how many monomials are there. So, you know, how many monomials without looking at the coefficient or with coefficient 1?
I have V variables I'm going
right.
to deal with. I'm only using the first two
mm-hmm.
instead of all of them. So I have some zero exponents.
Yeah, right. I mean, some of these, you know. That's right. And so anyway, so then you just have two stars. So this is just the dumb coding, okay? So then anyway, I have V stars and I have up to N ones. And so the total length of the string is, if I look at the exact order N, it's N plus V or it's less than N plus V. Yes?
Why do you have V stars? I mean, if it's two variables, it's only one star.
Okay, I put one in the end, okay, in my coding, okay? Okay, so basically all I have is lots of ones, and I have some stars sitting in there, and now I see there is just N plus V, choose V ways of arranging these, okay? So that's the answer of how many coefficients there are. Now, how many monomials are there of exact order n? It's the same game, except there I know that these guys add up to n, and so then I get, then I get this one. So basically, just by looking at such a coding, all these things are trivial. If you don't, you can also try to derive this by induction in the number of variables and the order, and then, you know, you do some little Pascal triangle thing. That also works, but this way it's really trivial. Now, another interesting question, how many possible products of two monomials are there up to two to order n? Now, why is that important? Because if we want to multiply these things, we just have to know how many multiplications do I need to carry out? Well, and that is not just this number of coefficients times this number of coefficients, because we throw away all the stuff that is of higher order. So how many ways is there to make products of two monomials up to a total order n? Well, for this, I know that the sum of orders of the first one plus the sum of orders of the second one is less than or equal to 2n. And so then I can code any such allowed product again in such a way where I now have 2v stars, one for the first batch, one for the second batch, and I have up to 2n ones, okay? I still have up to n, that's very important, I have up to n ones, because the total order is limited to n. Okay, and so I immediately get that the number of multiplications that can occur for results to be less than or equal to order n is n plus 2v, choose 2v. So basically I just doubled the numbers of stars in there. So this one is slightly non-trivial, but it comes out of this very easily. Now, how do we deal with these? I will first show you one method that was proposed by Andreas Griewank in 92 after he heard about our higher order stuff. He called me up and said, Martin, yeah, what you're doing here is nice and dandy, but of course it's very complicated. And so we know how to do univariate AD. So can't we just do the following? So if I want to, say, do second order polynomials, well, I do, so second order, say, in two variables, I do three evaluations. I calculate variate the x direction. That gives me the derivative of x and the second derivative of x. I do the same in the y direction. That gives me y and second derivative of y. And I do one along the diagonal. And from this, I can also recover then the mixed derivative x and y. Okay, so the idea is to compute many univariate derivatives in different directions and determine the higher mixed partials from linear algebra. So this is a little bit like fitting coefficients of a Runge-Kutta integrator. So you just try to match things so that your polynomials check out. Okay, and so you can figure that if you're patient enough, you can work this out. And one can actually reconstruct all these higher derivatives in such a way. And the advantage is you have to deal only with univariate things. Now, what are the properties of this? It's conceptually simple, requires only univariate AD, which we knew well how to do, and there's no complicated addressing schemes. However, usually there is some no-free lunch theorem here. The limitations of this is it requires multiple passes, and the linear algebra becomes quite unwieldy, and what is worse, if you go to many variables in higher orders, it is quite ill-conditioned. Especially in a verified setting, this is not a good territory to be in. Okay? Now also, it cannot easily accommodate sparsity in the derivatives because a zero that appears in some kind of mixed partial, well, that will then be the result of some linear algebra operation where everything cancels out. Okay? So for sparsity, this isn't that good. And also, it cannot be used very well, at least not very well, with Taylor models. And why? For those, we need to know in each step of the operation what the coefficients are of the intermediate results. Okay, and so if I were to use this scheme, then that means in every step I have to do my linear algebra reconstruction. That's not good. So this method is okay if you have a long code list and in the end you want your derivatives, but if you want to have it in between, which you need for the Taylor models, then that's not so good. Okay, now, how does the direct method work? The idea is to accumulate all Taylor coefficients simultaneously, and the key problem is to determine a particular arrangement of all derivatives or Taylor coefficients. That doesn't matter one way or another. And now, the advantages are, this can be combined with sparsity treatment. Well, you just store only non-zero coefficients. There's no need to go through a code list repeatedly. No need for linear algebra. What is also interesting, one can show this requires fewer operations, even in a dense case, and can be used for Taylor models. The limitations, and again, no free lunch, it requires a very sophisticated addressing scheme for the multiplication, and the efficiency of the whole algorithm, well, that's always true with these things, always limited by that of the multiplication, because that goes, that definitely requires more operations than the addition. In the univariate case, the square of the number of operations of the addition, and in the multivariate case, it was n plus 2v choose 2v divided by n plus v choose v. Okay? So, how does one do this then, if the storage is such a mess and trees are even messier? Well, we represent each non-zero derivative by its Taylor coefficient and several coding integers. So, a Taylor coefficient, actually it's better not to use derivatives, but Taylor coefficients, even if you want derivatives, and coding integers. Why is it better to use Taylor coefficients? Well, those have the advantage that when you multiply such things, there's no need for any binomial adjustment coefficients. So the Taylor coefficient of x squared in the result is just the Taylor coefficient of x squared of the first one times the second part plus the Taylor coefficient of x of each multiplied plus the other one with constant and second order part. No need for any juggling with binomial coefficients. Okay? Now, the addition in such a representation is easy. That's like going through phone books, phone books from top to bottom. So you keep these sorted in a certain way, and if you find matching things, then you add them. If they don't match, then you copy one of them. So if the coding integers agree, you add coefficients, and then if the result is zero, increment P1 and P2. Oops, there's an I missing, okay. Sorry. If the result is non-zero, increment the result, copy the coefficient sum, and so forth. And if the coding integers do not agree, copy term with the coding integers that come first in whatever scheme we choose, and I'll tell you that in a minute, and increment its pointer by its pointer only by P. So it's really like merging phone books, and if you find the same person again, then you do something special, otherwise you just copy. Okay, now how does the multiplication work? So we want to have the n plus v factorial divided by n factorial and v factorial monomials in a certain order. The most intuitive way is to let mi be a monomial stored in the ith component, and im denote the position of the monomial m. Okay? And then I have to do the following. Sorry about the fine print here. Now, if I do this, I have to find for every coefficient in the result, those coefficients, the monomials of which multiply together to the monomial of this guy. Well, you see, this is the direct equivalent of the one variable case where this was trivial. Here, the problem is, it's very difficult because you can't really find these very well. Okay? Even if you pre-store them for every I, then you have the problem, this cannot take care of sparsity. So you could make, you could decide on an order and a number of variables, and once for each I, you calculate all its new and new contributions that feed into it. You could do that, but then you cannot take care of sparsity. And actually, sparsity is very important because in a multivariate setting, you always have the situation that certain intermediate terms depend only on a few of the variables. Or, if intermediate terms are even low-order polynomials, then they just don't have higher order to begin with. Okay? So, the better way is to turn this around from the 1D case, multiply guys that do not contribute to the order. This avoids vanishing coefficients. And now, the question is, how does one store this in such a way that stuff can easily be found? Now, let us look at the simplest scheme to do this efficiently. You have those integers, and you define an n describing this monomial as just taking these integers and viewing them as digits in a base n plus 1 representation. Note, if I choose the base higher than the maximum order that appears for each one of these, then such a representation is unique, okay? And I can code things in such a way. Now, however, actually, why is this good? I'll come to this later. First, we observe no coding can exceed n, well, every possible coding lies below n plus 1 to the v's power, but not all such codings occur, because this can also catch codings where the sum of the exponents is way beyond n, which is useless, okay? So now, the nice thing about this is that multiplying monomials is very, very simple. Why? Because the coding integer of the product is just the sum of the coding integers of the factors. So far, so good. This is utterly simple. And so if I have two terms and want to multiply them, I can just immediately calculate what the coding integer of, it's the totally natural ordering of the coefficients. So this guy has the highest weight, this guy has the lowest weight, and it's very easy. It has one big disadvantage. The codings are bounded by n plus 1 to the v's power, and the array needs to have at least that length. And so if you do something that in our Taylor model case would be considered moderate, namely 10 variables and ninth order, you need 10 to the 10. And that's A, a lot of storage, and B, anyway larger than the integers that you can represent on a computer. So that thing also doesn't work, but one can generalize this to a multi-stage coding where you just break up the integers. Whoa, okay. You break up the integers into different parts that, you know, you just take half of them in the first one and the other half in the second one. And then the situation becomes much more favorable. You can also generalize this to higher stages yet, if you wish. And in this situation, you have the ability to, even within the range of integers, address, even in a two-stage coding, all the possibilities that can arise in our setting. And so now, since Kyoko already stood up, I have to, maybe I'll skip these coding examples, so this will be on the website. You can, these are particular examples that show you the coding integers, and you can look this up on the website. So here they are for one case. One thing that I want to mention very briefly, it is very important that one can do weighting, which means that different variables have to be carried to different orders. So, for example, in a numerical integrator, you want to have the time step to really high order, but the dependence on initial conditions may be to less order. And I will pass on how this works, but that also fits into this scheme very naturally. Okay, I'll skip this example. So here just some nice numbers of, you know, what you can do with different dimensions, different orders, and weighting and so forth. You can all look this at the on the web page. Now let me try to finish this part and say a few words about the high precision stuff. So we use a two-stage coding with a sparse storage, and if one really wants to push it, one could generalize it to three-stage. More you would really never need. So you know what Taylor models are, and we have a validated implementation. We have talked about this before, so I'll skip this part. Well, actually, there is nothing here that I need to talk about. But what I want to discuss now is some way how you can do Taylor models even more efficient, and how you can do in a very natural way multi-precision ones. So first of all, it turns out the following simple trick helps a lot. So first of all, one sentence, how you do the conventional Taylor model stuff. So whenever you have a product to execute and add to its target address, then you put a little increment bounding the error of what you make into a variable. And so Natalie knows this stuff very well and has even been kind enough to look through our code that this is all kosher. Okay, but one can do much better with a very simple, dumb trick. You just decompose each polynomial into purely positive parts and purely negative parts. And then you execute separately. You multiply, you calculate a Q plus and a Q minus, where in the Q plus you collect all those things that have positive results, and in the Q minus you collect all things that have negative results. Well, the advantage of this is all coefficients that you produce for Q plus will be just adding more and more and more stuff to a positive result, and for such an operation, you don't have to do individual error accounting. There's a simple way to do the error accounting once after the fact. And the same thing here. Okay? So there is no need for the TM tallying variable. Just when you're done with Q plus and Q minus, then you go through there and look and you figure out what the error is. And doing this, you can do multiplication of Taylor models almost at the same speed of just multiplication of the polynomials. Now, higher precision Taylor models, well, of course, one way would be to go in and say, okay, well, I mean, Taylor models were things with floating point coefficients, so let's just make those coefficients higher precision. Turns out that's a really bad idea, because if and only if a Taylor model is a good representation, which means it has a small remainder bound, then this thing will have the property that as you go up in order, the coefficients become smaller and smaller. So if you plot their logarithm, it will be a nice straight line. So you have a few variables, a few coefficients that are big, namely the low order ones, and you have many that are small. So if you store everything in high precision, all the small stuff you're doing overkill. So you want some kind of smart adaptive precision. And a good way to do this is to store high precision numbers as just unevaluated sums of floating point numbers. That's something that high precision people are very familiar with. And so if epsilon is an approximate machine epsilon, then we just write each number in such a way where each of the A's has similar magnitude. And so how can you store such things? Well, you just introduce one more variable in your Taylor representation, and you just know yourself, this is my machine epsilon, but you don't have to tell anybody. You just store them like this, and then they are stored in the completely natural scheme of things. There's no need to change anything, no changing any data types. It's just one extra variable. What is important, usually you don't want to carry this variable to the same order that you want to carry the original variable, and hence you are in a situation where this ability to have different variables to different orders is very important. So, you know, you may just end up wanting to use quadruple precision. That means you need this guy only to first order. Okay? Other than that, it fits into the regular storage scheme. How can you do multiplication? Well, first of all, the fact that you have the epsilon as a power representation, and you never exceed in products the maximum power of the original factors, that keeps things in perspective and avoids dealing with stuff that is really irrelevantly small with two high powers of epsilon. But now you can do even more. Those coefficients that are less than 1 over epsilon away from the cutoff or the accumulated remainder bounds, they go into one polynomial, and those that are further away. Now, what does that mean? So this is basically the conventional Taylor model stuff that has a noise threshold that is less than 1 over epsilon, and this is stuff that is relevant in the high precision world. Now, the first polynomials you multiply just in the regular way, and then you have to worry about, and for those, you pre-split each of the coefficients that appear into two half-length double precision variables, as in the two product algorithm. So there is a way to take any double precision number have half as many digits, and the advantage is if you multiply two such half-length guides, it's accurate to machine precision. Okay, and now the nice thing about this approach is the pre-splitting cost is linear in length of only the higher term polynomials, and it is not quadratic, which is if you were to just apply the regular two-product algorithm whenever you want to multiply two terms. So you, first of all, you take the stuff that anyway doesn't matter out of the equation, and then you work only on the higher precision terms and do your pre-splitting. And that's it.
I was wondering if you're familiar with the work of Mike Monaghan and Roman Pierce from San Jose University on polynomial representation.
Not exactly. In fact, I heard their name, and I'm not exactly sure what they have been doing.
They have some very impressive results on a certain data structure for sparse, multivariate polynomials.
Okay. That would. So in our case, actually we have a benchmark. So basically the point is, if you have a sparse representation, one thing you can never avoid is that each of the coefficients of order, of a given order, has to be multiplied with each of the coefficients up to n minus that order. That work of the multiplying of the coefficients can never be avoided. We know that in our case, the bookkeeping overhead for this, so we timed this by taking out the bookkeeping, that is only about 20% of the pure raw floating point numbers. So, well, this works. I forgot now the two-stage bookkeeping. What the limitations are, but you are limited by not by the storage of the bookkeeping stuff, you're limited by the CPU time that you have to deal with. So 10th order in 10 variables is no problem. 10th order in 20 variables, I think that is probably at the end. So 20 variables, maybe order 7, you can still do somewhat conveniently. No.
The next speaker is Jim Jenkins, and he is going to end the talk. A high-order method for computation of Fibonacci sure bound of small functions near the numerator. Everybody is laughing.
Well, I'm Yoon Kyung Kim now. Well. Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, so Yoon Kyung Kim could not come. She had some health issues over the last year, and so I agreed to give an abbreviated version of her work. And actually, this work that she did builds on earlier work of Kyoko. And so the idea is, how can we, in a rigorous global optimization setting, where we have to throw away boxes based on knowing well a lower bound, how can we do this well? Okay, so to put things into perspective, let's start out with a simple one-dimensional example. Let's take the cosine function and represent it in the most dumb way, namely by its power series to order 60. Okay, why is it really dumb? Because it has this minus 1 sign that always flips, and that produces just lots and lots of numerical instability. So in terms of interval analysis, this has a dependency problem that is made stupidly large as x goes away from very small to very large. And on the other hand, 60 is enough so that you can study the behavior and you have periodicity. So you can look what happens at 1 quarter pi, what happens at 5 over 4 pi, see how they compare. So this is a nice example to do some comparison tests. And so that's what we have here. Here is an evaluation at 1 quarter pi of that cosine. with different methods. And so you see that up here is an interval method, which actually the power of 2 of the negative power of 2 of the box width. So for big boxes, this interval method is even better. Then it kind of stabilizes, while other methods have errors that go down. So the Taylor models behave like that. So actually here you have something that interval people know well, the mean value form, the centered form, the conventional centered form as introduced way back by Ray Moore, and then first order Taylor models, and all the higher order Taylor models behave the same. Now, there is a very simple bounding scheme that works when the linear part dominates, the so-called linear dominated bounder, and that achieves behavior that in higher order Taylor models is much better until you hit the floating point floor, and you get here estimated approximation orders of this scheme, and you see that the eighth order method has a seventh order relative approximation order. Now, as you go out, you hit the dependency more, and even the plain Taylor models, where bounding is done by evaluating the polynomial interval arithmetic, behave better. Now, the linear dominated bounder is better yet, but here you already start to be far below the behavior of the conventional clever interval methods, and so as you get further out, which here we are further out yet, you even see that the higher order methods, Taylor models, beat the third order Taylor model. Okay, and so it continues, and that difference becomes bigger and bigger. Here is the situation of the over estimation that is produced as a function of the position where we do this. So you have pi over 4, pi over 4 plus pi over 4 plus 2 pi, and you see these guys go up, but the Taylor models, they stay down, except that the third order method also takes off a little bit. And here is the same result with the linear dominated bounder. Now, the linear dominated bounder we had discussed often. What happens if you do the same thing at a place that is not linearly dominated, but at one of the places where the cosine has its maximum? Okay, in that case, you have initially, for the first time this appears, such a behavior, and then as you go further out, the higher order Taylor models become better, just because they can suppress the dependency, but they cannot really, the linear dominated bounder does nothing here. Okay, so that behavior is the same. Then, here is the estimated approximation order, and so centered form and mean value form are at 1. Now, this is relative order, so interval people like to think of these methods as second order methods, but if you divide it by the original box width, you get to 1. Okay, and now actually for the interval purists, a question I will not answer right now, I pose as a challenge, why do the Taylor models here, for this particular case, have empirical approximation order of 3? While the centered form and the mean value form have 1, and we usually like to think that unless you do smart stuff with Taylor models, the convergence rate is the same. So Marcus, you can think about that. Okay. So as we go further out, nothing changes, so the linear dominated bounder doesn't do anything, and these two pictures look the same, and the only reason why the Taylor models are better is, well, by some strange coincidence here that they have a better approximation order, and the higher order Taylor models beat the dependency. Okay, so far so good. We had this implementation of the Taylor model arithmetic, and let me skip this and now come to the beginning of the smart stuff that was done by Kyoko. Well, if we have, well, after all, this polynomial has second-order terms and higher-order terms, and so if we have, if we look at the second-order part, this is a quadratic form, and then we can break this into an ordered LDL D we can apply an ordered LDL decomposition. This is kind of an extended Kolesky decomposition that also works if it is not fully positive definite. So what you get is it's like a Kolesky decomposition where on the diagonal you not only have positive terms but possibly negative ones. Let's leave it at that. The important thing is when you are near a local minimizer, this quadratic part will contain only positive elements under the assumption that the corresponding second derivatives are minimizer. If it's an isolated minimizer, that situation happens, and then as you go a little bit away, it prevails for a while. Okay, so you basically near where it counts, box rejection is hardest near local minimizers. Near there, this works particularly well. Or you always end up with, even if you try the generalized Kolesky decomposition, nevertheless, you find, okay, the regular one did work. Okay, now how does there's now one way to do bounding rigorously for any quadratic quadratic form, whether it's positive definite or not. And actually, I want to skip this and come to something that works in the case near the minimizer where it's particularly hard, the so-called quadratic fast bounder. And it yields universal third-order approximation area rate in this area. So we decompose the Taylor model in such a way, we introduce the Q that can be easily bounded from below and that is sufficiently simple to allow bounding. Well, you can, for example, take Q to be the positive definite part of P. Uh-huh. Well, then, since this H is positive definite, well, of course, the lower bound of this is zero. So you have a whole bunch of polynomial parts that just have a lower bound of zero. Now, that does remove all the second order parts of P already. And that's already quite impressive. So you have only linear parts left and third order parts. But you can do even better yet. Well, we know that Q is also bounded below if I take instead of x minus any x0, as long as the same x0 appears on both sides. Obviously, this thing is also bounded below to zero. It works for any x0 I wish, and I still have that. Now, what choices of x0 are good? Well, it turns out if x0 is the unique local minimizer of the quadratic part P, then the lower bound of the linear part is zero. If that happens. Furthermore, the lower bound of the remaining stuff that I'm not catching, because then I'm taking out the linear part and the quadratic part, is accurate to order 3. And for the proof of this, you just have to sit down a little bit. So if x0 is in the middle, then anyway, everything is okay. Otherwise, it readily follows from the Kuhn-Tucker conditions when you are on the edge. Now, remark, the closer we get to the minimizer, the closer we are to order 3 cutoff. Now, in practice, it is not hard if positive definite and hence the thing convex. It's very easy with any numerical method to get very close to that cutoff. Okay? So now we have a third order cutoff test. We make a sequence of points that converge to the minimizer, converge in the conventional numeric sense, that kind of get closer. And so if with one of them we can already reject the box, we throw the box away. Otherwise, we make one more step to try to get closer. And as we get closer, the lower bound will get sharper and sharper, and hopefully eventually we can reject stuff. And how do you do this? Actually, it's very simple to make such a sequence, so you can just determine a feasible descent, so you have a box in which you want to stay, so you just compute the gradient, move in the direction of the gradient, except when you are on the edge, then you don't allow yourself to go outside the box. So this is very cheap and produces a third order cutoff. So how does it work? We take a little example here that has the following form with the matrix A that has 2's on the diagonal, minus 1's below, and 3's up here. Now, this is just chosen in a somewhat naughty way to artificially introduce some dependency problem here, which is otherwise a very, very simple problem. In fact, this thing one can easily show has a minimum A, and is positive definite. Now, we want to see what happens. We take many boxes in the neighborhood and check whether box rejection works with interval evaluation, centered form, and QFB. And to be fair, to see how well this works, we output how many steps in the QFB are needed. So we do this for different numbers of variables, and 5 to the V boxes that are actually equidistantly distributed. So the interval method cannot reject any. The centered form can reject about half of them in 4 variables. The QFB algorithm rejects all except one, which contains the minimum, and that it better not reject. And now here is the iteration count needed to achieve this, and you see it required on average only 0.31 iterations of this X-naught mechanism. Then here it continues. You have many boxes in 10 variables, okay, 9 million. Intervals cannot reduce anything, and in the high dimensions also the centered form cannot reject almost anything, and QFB rejects everything except the right box, and the iteration count is only 0.55. So for practical problems, this is a very useful thing. Okay, so then here are some examples. Let me only go to the... Unfortunately, this takes... The loading of this takes a long time. Sorry about this. At least please admire my replacement for the hourglass. Okay, so this is the number of steps for an interval method. Now, here is a more interesting problem in 2D and 4D that is kind of hard because it's shallow, and here is the situation of boxes just when they are rejected with an interval method and centered form and the LDB-QFB combination, and you see the boxes are rejected much more quickly. But let me rush. I want to come to the higher order extension of this. Okay, so here you see an interval would need 350,000 evaluations of boxes in 4D, and the centered form a little less, and the LDB needs about 7,000. LDB QFB, I'm sorry. Now, how does it... Let me also skip these nice Leonard Jones potentials. Well, except maybe to say that... this works quite well in this situation. And now let me come to this higher order bounder. Turns out what worked for second order can be made to work for higher orders. And you can actually make rigorous lower bounders that produce the lower bound near an isolated minimum to any order of accuracy you wish. Well, how does this work? Remember, the trick was that we took the second order part out of the polynomial and dealt with this separately. And in fact, it turned out it was good to move away from just xhx to some suitably chosen point xc. And now, the point why this works is for the very simple observation that this expression is surely always non-negative. However, the amazing, it's actually trivial, but incredibly helpful, if you have any nonlinear polynomial t, then still such an expression, whatever that t is bounded below by zero. So basically, this is a nonlinear extension of this expression here. So now the goal is to see if not only can we remove the second order part by doing this kind of thing, but maybe that we can find a t that up to order n exactly equals to this. And if we can do that, then we have found a lower order bounder. Now this looks like a hard problem, so I mean you could actually view this as a linear algebra problem. Now, you know, these guys have coefficients, and so you could set up a big linear system to calculate the coefficients of these t's, set up a linear system that relates these coefficients t to those of h. That might be one way, but it turns out there is a much simpler way that's actually quite elegant. Now, we write t in an order-by-order representation where tm is that part of t that contains monomials of only exact order m. And then similarly, we introduce t less than or equal to m, which is the partial sum up to m. Okay? Now, t1 is y, where y is just a change of variable. It's x minus x0 for further simplicity. And now we define a sequence of real-valued polynomial functions s in such a way I will iteratively produce tm's. And now sm is supposed to be what is still left over after I did my best up to order m minus 1 and apply this and subtract it from the original thing. So sm is what is left over there. And we want to see if we can iteratively beat down SM order by order. Well, suppose we have already in our inductive argument determined T less than or equal to M minus 1. We want to determine TM. So we have an SM sitting here. And now we want to go through this. We have T in our department right now, so I should be there, but I can't. So anyway, so now we look at this expression here. We have the stuff that we already know plus the unknown TM, and now we just manipulate this in a clever way, keeping only those terms of at most order M plus 1. So first we multiply these separately, we get four terms. Well, actually it's only three because the cross term, because H is symmetric, can be combined into one. So that's happened here. This doesn't have a coefficient of 1/2 anymore. The other terms, they're just sitting here. Now, we proceed. We realize, well, by definition of my SM minus 1, this expression here is SM minus 1. That's what was removed, that's what's left over after removal of the lower order stuff. Then I have this thing remaining. And now what happens to this? The nice thing is, if in the induction step, well, this contains only terms of order 2m. And if m is greater than or equal to 2, which is where I start, then this is beyond order m plus 1, so I can disregard this. And so what I'm left with is the following. I have s of m minus 1, then I have the previously accumulated stuff, the stuff that I want to find, and an h. Okay? That establishes the requirement for the sort tm. Okay? Now, we observe SM minus 1 has a special structure, namely SM minus 1 has no constant term. So that means SM minus 1 has every term there has at least one of the variables appearing. Well, it's kind of a stupid thing, but if you have nonlinear terms, non-constant terms in here, it means they contain at least one variable. Okay? Now, why is that useful? Well, that means I can factor out one variable out of this SM. And it doesn't matter how you do this, it works in, of course, if I have x1, x2, I could either factor out x1 or x2. In this case, it's probably better to factor out 1/2 x1 and factor out 1/2 x2 and split it. But anyway, I can write SM minus 1 as y times the identity matrix times a new S tilde. And so then, if I do this and compare with the previous result, if this is now written as y identity times S tilde, then I can read off that I just need to choose Tm of y as the inverse of the Hessian times S tilde. And so inductively, I can succeed and remove all terms that appear and have my polynomial written completely as one new polynomial times the Hessian times another new polynomial. All terms are in there, and I can bound it below to zero. Now, does it really produce a high-order bounder? Let's take a look. Here is a function to test it. It's made in a somewhat complicated way on purpose. And here is the behavior of the actual, so for this function, although it's complicated, one can easily get its minimum. So here is the behavior of the overestimation for the lower bound as a function of order. And in this case, the linear dominated bounder does not work because we are in a territory very close to the minimum, and yet we still have maintained our empirical approximation order that just goes up with the order of the Taylor polynomial. Here is another example where this thing is slightly shifted. You see the behavior is qualitatively the same. And let's stop here. This concludes the talk. So basically, we have achieved near minimizer, which is where it counts, the ability to find lower bounds to arbitrary order.
Before the coffee break, is there any question?
This one? Actually, how much in practice? Well, okay, this one is done to order 9 in this example. It's hard to read. It works to any order. Now, you know, the interesting question is, in a real optimizer, what do you want to use? That we don't know yet, really. Maybe a little more than 2, but maybe not all that much, but it's kind of academically interesting that you can do it. So. Well, this lives in the Taylor model world where any noise that may appear is in the remainder bound. But, you know, we kind of assume that that remainder bound itself scales with order n plus 1. So there isn't really, well, if there is noise, then better not that much. Basically the bounding of the polynomial happens with the same accuracy order as the remainder bound itself. So. Yeah. Let's thank her. She had a really hard time last year health-wise, and so it's impossible for her to travel right now.